In Julie Berry's Lovely War, the Greek goddess Aphrodite stands trial before her husband Hephaestus, caught in a golden net with her lover Ares. To defend herself, she presents her masterpiece, two love stories that unfold during World War I. The novel has captivated readers with its blend of mythology, history, and romance, earning spots on numerous best books lists and praise from critics who call it breathtaking and achingly beautiful. Reese Witherspoon featured it in her book club, noting how it brilliantly interweaves divine intervention with human resilience. What makes this story particularly powerful is how Berry uses immortal narrators to illuminate the fleeting, precious nature of mortal love against the backdrop of humanity's darkest hour. Aphrodite's tale begins in London, November 1917, where Hazel Windicott, a talented but shy pianist, plays at a parish dance to avoid socializing. A young British soldier named James Aldridge watches her, captivated by both her music and presence. When their eyes meet during a refrain, something electric passes between them before James disappears into the crowd. Later, he approaches her after she finishes playing, and despite Hazel's initial awkwardness, they connect instantly. They share two dances, growing closer with each moment, until Hazel daringly kisses James on the cheek and gives him her address. That night, unable to sleep, Hazel sits by her bedroom window, pressing her cheek against the cool glass. She thinks of James going to war and fears what might happen to the boy with dark brown eyes. Meanwhile, James finds himself standing outside her flat above the King's Whiskers barbershop, gazing up at her window. When Hazel spots him, she drops a note inviting him to meet at a tea shop the next morning. Their courtship unfolds with tender urgency against the ticking clock of war. At the tea shop, they share lemon cake, conjured by Aphrodite herself, disguised as a waitress, and begin to know each other. The next day, James takes Hazel to Royal Albert Hall for a concert, where the music creates a perfect moment of connection. As they part, James promises to kiss her when they meet again before his deployment, a promise war prevents him from keeping when he's suddenly sent to France days earlier than expected. "Just 3 days, that felt like a lifetime," Aphrodite observes of their brief courtship. Through letters, James and Hazel continue to know each other more deeply despite their separation, creating a lifeline across the channel that sustains them both through the horrors to come. Apollo, god of music, introduces the second love story, taking us to Carnegie Hall in 1912, where 15-year-old Aubrey Edwards sits behind one of Ken upright grand pianos in James Reese Europe's groundbreaking Clef Club Orchestra. This historic concert of Negro music at a major concert hall represents a breakthrough for Black musicians playing original compositions. Young Aubrey falls in love with performing, and Apollo hears his wish to play for crowds every night and blesses it, though he knows Aubrey will pay a price. 5 years later, Private Aubrey Edwards performs with Lieutenant Europe's Army Band of the 15th New York Infantry Regiment, later renamed the 369th Harlem Hellfighters, at Camp Wadsworth in South Carolina. The all-Black regiment faces constant danger and discrimination, holding goodwill concerts to ease tensions despite the governor's attempts to prevent Black soldiers from entering the state. Aubrey, now on percussion instead of piano, must carefully avoid even looking at dancing white girls, knowing the deadly consequences. In January 1918, Aubrey's regiment arrives in France, where, despite the cold and uncertainty of war, the soldiers find comfort in music. When one begins singing, "I Want to Be Ready," others join in, creating an impromptu quartet that soon has the whole train car singing. This musical brotherhood sustains them as they face not only the enemy across no man's land, but also the racism of their own countrymen. The stories intersect when Hazel arrives in Saint-Nazaire as a YMCA entertainment secretary. While playing Beethoven's Pathétique at the Y Hut piano late one night, she meets Aubrey, who transforms her classical pieces into ragtime and jazz with effortless skill. His confidence and humor charm Hazel as he declares himself the Emperor of Jazz while demonstrating his ability to improvise on any tune. The third central character emerges when Hazel meets Colette Fournier, a Belgian YMCA volunteer with stylish bobbed black hair. Colette gradually reveals her tragic story. Her entire family was murdered by Germans in Dinant in 1914, and she's been with the YMCA for 4 years, providing comfort to soldiers while carrying her own deep wounds. When Aubrey hears Colette singing, he's mesmerized. Despite the strict segregation enforced by the U.S. Army and the dangers facing black soldiers who interact with white women, Aubrey begins visiting the Y Hut after hours to play piano while Colette sings. Their musical connection quickly becomes something deeper, though both carry heavy burdens: Colette's grief for her murdered family and first love Stefan, and Aubrey's awareness of the deadly consequences if Southern white soldiers discover their relationship. The danger materializes when Aubrey is confronted by a racist white soldier with a pistol who threatens him for entering the white women's hut. Though Aubrey manages to overpower him and take his gun, the incident foreshadows greater tragedy. Meanwhile, James experiences the horrors of trench warfare, discovering he's a natural marksman and being trained as a sniper, a role that forces him to make life and death decisions about distant figures seen through a scope. The two love stories develop in parallel, with both couples struggling to find moments of connection amid war's chaos. Hazel and James arrange to meet in Paris during his brief leave, while Aubrey and Colette share intimate late-night music sessions that evolve into a tender romance. Both relationships deepen through vulnerability, James confessing his fear that killing is turning him into a monster, Colette revealing her survivor's guilt and nightmares about her lost family. Eris, god of war, testifies to the brutality that threatens these fragile relationships. On March 21, 1918, the massive German spring offensive begins with an extraordinary bombardment, shells falling so fast they create one continuous roar of destruction. James and his comrades face German stormtroopers infiltrating their trenches through heavy fog. After saving his friend Frank Mason from one attacker, James witnesses Frank's death when artillery strikes him moments later. The tragedy of war touches Aubrey as well. After confiding to his bunkmate Joey Rice about his relationship with Colette, Aubrey wakes to find Joey missing. Following his instincts to the latrine, he discovers Joey's body, beaten and strangled, likely by racist soldiers who had been hunting for Aubrey himself. Lieutenant Europe arranges for Aubrey to leave immediately for Aix-les-Bains on the morning train, removing him from danger while handling the situation his way. Hades, god of the underworld, describes Joey Rice's soul crossing from Earth to eternity, arriving first at Asphodel, a vast grassy field dotted with white flowers, before finding himself at his parents' Harlem apartment. Joey mourns that news of his murder will devastate his parents, especially if they learn how it happened. Hades assures Joey that he can remain with his family as long as he wishes. Similarly, when Frank Mason arrives in Hades' realm, confused and calling for James, he weeps for his family, especially his wife and son who will never know him. Hades offers small comfort, telling him he can still send them comfort and help, that sleep and childhood bring them closer. Communication breaks down as the war intensifies. When Aubrey's musical composition for Colette is forwarded by a disapproving Mrs. Davies to Army HQ with a complaint about Negro soldiers behaving wantonly, it's simply thrown away. Similarly, James's letters to Hazel are returned with a false note claiming she was dismissed in disgrace for entertaining men of ill repute. As the Fifth Army retreats in disarray during Operation Michael, mailbags are overlooked or lost, and many letters never reach their intended recipients. James suffers a mental breakdown after witnessing Frank's death, drifting in and out of consciousness in a hospital, tormented by nightmares and the phantom sound of incoming missiles. Eventually transferred to Maudsley Military Hospital in London, he returns home physically recovered but emotionally fragile. When he receives Mrs. Davies' letter falsely accusing Hazel of immoral behavior, he doesn't believe it, but decides he's now unfit for Hazel's love anyway, just a shell of himself. Meanwhile, Aubrey, devastated by Joey's death and believing his relationship with Colette endangered her, makes the painful choice to leave her letters unanswered. Though he loves her, he believes he has nothing to offer her now, especially after Joey died because of their relationship. Both women refuse to give up easily. Hazel travels to James's home in Chelmsford, only to be turned away when he refuses to see her. Rather than leaving town, she accepts a position at the local vicarage, playing piano for Sunday school while waiting for another chance to see James. Colette, discovering a newspaper article about the 369th Infantry Regiment, writes a letter seeking confirmation of Aubrey's fate, determined to handle the truth, whatever it may be. The turning point for James arrives during an emotionally charged visit to Adelaide Mason, Frank's pregnant widow. With trembling hands and a heavy heart, James painfully reveals the full circumstances of Frank's death, not just the sanitized version in the official letter. He describes Frank's final moments of bravery and his unwavering thoughts of home, fulfilling his sacred obligation to his friend by presenting Adelaide with Frank's belongings, his singed prayer book still carrying the scent of smoke, his Medal of Valor earned in his last battle, and money for the children Frank would never meet. Though physically and emotionally exhausted by this confession, James finally finds a measure of peace in completing this duty, sensing that Frank would have wanted the truth shared with grace and dignity. At the windswept Lowestoft beach, James experiences a profound spiritual moment. Standing alone at the water's edge, he feels Frank's presence as clearly as the salt spray on his face. In this ethereal conversation, Frank's spirit seems to absolve James of his survivor's guilt and urges him to embrace life and love with Hazel, despite the war's lasting scars. Frank's imagined words echo what he always stood for in life: hope, love, and the courage to move forward. When James catches up to Hazel in the churning water, his confession comes raw and honest. He can never be the carefree boy she once knew. The war has fundamentally changed him. His hands that once held her tenderly have now taken lives. His dreams are haunted by the trenches, and his laughter doesn't come as easily. As she begins to walk away, tears mixing with the sea spray, nature intervenes. A powerful wave pushes her back into his arms. In this moment, James finally lets his defenses crumble, spinning her around in the shallow water, their shared laughter healing something broken inside him. For Aubrey and Colette, their reunion unfolds unexpectedly when he appears like a ghost at her Paris doorway. Her initial shock dissolves into tears of relief and joy. Followed by hours of walking through rain-slicked Parisian streets, their footsteps echoing against ancient stones as they share their burdens. Aubrey speaks of Joey's senseless murder and the crushing weight of surviving when others didn't. Colette, drawing from her own losses, helps him understand that his survivor's guilt mirrors her own experience, the complex pain of being alive when loved ones perished. Though Aubrey must return to the front that very night, they share precious moments of connection. A shared meal at a small cafe, tender touches that speak volumes, and whispered plans of a future life together in New York after the war's end. Dreams that give them both strength to endure the uncertain days ahead. As the war enters its final, devastating phase, Hazel and Colette meticulously plan reunions with their beloveds during precious leave periods. The girls spend hours discussing their plans, writing letters, and coordinating schedules around military movements. Their excitement builds as they board the train, carrying small gifts and wearing their best dresses, only for fate to intervene with brutal swiftness. A German shell strikes their carriage directly, transforming their journey of hope into a scene of chaos and destruction. Hazel bears the brunt of the attack, her face and hands shredded by exploding glass, the very hands that had created such beautiful music. In the liminal space between life and death, Hazel finds herself transported to a dreamlike version of the Royal Albert Hall, its vastness both familiar and otherworldly. The space is filled with shadows and starlight, and as she approaches the grand piano on stage, her movements are weightless and graceful. Her fingers dance across the keys with supernatural perfection, producing music more sublime than anything she had achieved in life. From the shadowy balcony, she glimpses James, her family, and all those she loves, watching with tears streaming down their faces. In this moment, she understands with perfect clarity that she has crossed the threshold between life and death. The scene shifts to Hades' dark throne room, where Aphrodite, in an unprecedented act of humility, kneels before the Lord of the Underworld. Her legendary beauty dims with genuine grief as she begs for Hazel's life. The negotiation between the gods is tense and loaded with ancient power. Hades, though initially unmoved, finds himself affected by Aphrodite's uncharacteristic display of selfless love for a mortal. His warning comes with the weight of divine law. Passion, love, and beauty, you know she can no longer have them all. The price of return must be paid in full. Hazel's return to consciousness is excruciating. For 3 days, she lies in a field hospital, her body sustained by revolutionary blood transfusions, a new medical technique that saves countless soldiers' lives. The pain is constant, and each change of bandages reveals the extent of her transformation. The mirrors in the ward have been covered, but she can feel the rough texture of healing scars beneath her fingertips. On her final night in the hospital, Hazel attempts to make the ultimate sacrifice. In a voice barely above a whisper, she tries to free James from their understanding, convinced that her altered appearance would become a lifelong burden for him. But James, who has witnessed the horrors of war and faced his own mortality in the trenches, shows a depth of character that transcends physical beauty. Drawing from his own experiences of feeling broken and unworthy, he refuses her sacrifice with quiet determination. Pulling a small gold ring from his pocket, one he'd carried through battles and bombardments, he tells her that life without her is no life at all. His love, tested by war and tragedy, emerges stronger than ever. The war finally ends at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month of 1918. James and Hazel marry at Christmas, with Aubrey playing and Colette singing at their wedding. They settle into a modest London flat and build their life together through James's architecture studies and Hazel's music, eventually having 2 children. Though James sometimes suffers from war trauma, Hazel helps him through it, and he eventually leads a veteran service group. The Harlem Hellfighters return to a hero's welcome in New York City, marching in a historic parade up Fifth Avenue. Aubrey brings Colette home to his family, where she's warmly embraced. Despite facing racism in the entertainment industry, they build a successful career in Harlem with recordings, sheet music, and radio performances as the jazz age begins. One ordinary morning, Aubrey casually proposes marriage to Colette, with his eavesdropping mother immediately beginning to plan their wedding celebration. In the divine realm, Aphrodite concludes her defense as Apollo reveals the true nature of the trial. It was Eris who was actually on trial all along for the suffering he caused. Left alone, Hephaestus and Aphrodite have a heart-to-heart, where he admits his brokenness might make him suitable for love. To his shock, Aphrodite reveals she's been waiting for him to offer himself to her, confessing that her relationship with Eris was merely a ploy to make Hephaestus jealous. As dawn breaks through the windows, Aphrodite suggests they could meet up some morning for tea and lemon cake, echoing Hazel and James's courtship. Hephaestus takes her hand and they share a kiss for the ages, finally beginning their true romance after eons of misunderstanding. Julie Barry's novel masterfully interweaves fiction with historical reality, anchoring its romance in the tumultuous landscape of World War I. James Rhys Europe emerged as a transformative figure in American music history. His 369th Infantry Regiment band, nicknamed the Harlem Hellfighters, introduced syncopated rhythms and early jazz to European audiences through performances that electrified both troops and civilians. Their music became a cultural bridge, demonstrating Black Americans' artistic genius even as they fought for democracy abroad. Nearly 400,000 Black American soldiers served in World War I, confronting a double battle against German forces and against deep-seated racism within their own military. The U.S. Army's segregation policies extended beyond American shores, implementing strict regulations prohibiting Black soldiers from interacting with white women overseas. In an especially egregious move, American officials pressured French authorities to distribute a secret memorandum maligning black troops' character and warning against social interaction, though French High Command, recognizing its racist nature, later ordered all copies destroyed. Many French civilians and military personnel rejected these attempts at enforced discrimination, treating black American soldiers with unprecedented respect and dignity. The homecoming of black veterans proved particularly fraught. Having experienced relative equality in France, these soldiers returned with heightened awareness of American injustice and renewed determination to secure their rights. Southern white supremacists, threatened by this confidence, responded with terrifying violence. The year 1919 saw a dramatic spike in lynchings, with black veterans specifically targeted, many for simply wearing their military uniforms in public. In cities like Washington, D.C. and Chicago, racial tensions erupted into deadly riots. Despite this brutal backlash, these veterans' experiences and resistance helped plant crucial seeds for the civil rights movement, establishing networks and strategies that would prove vital in coming decades. The war revolutionized women's roles, particularly in Britain, where severe labor shortages forced rapid social change. Women stepped into positions previously deemed exclusively male, operating trains, driving ambulances, maintaining factories, and even performing surgery. The Women's Land Army saw thousands working farms to maintain food production. This mass entry into the workforce definitively proved women's capabilities, helping secure voting rights, partially in Britain through the 1918 Representation of the People Act for women over 30, fully in 1928, and in America through the 19th Amendment in 1920. The war years also saw women taking public leadership roles in peace movements, labor organizing, and social reform, establishing precedents that would influence generations of activists. Lovely War powerfully illustrates how the fateful decisions made by aging generals and politicians in 1914 cascaded into tragedy for an entire generation of youth. While decorated officers planned strategies from comfortable headquarters, young men barely out of school faced the grinding horror of trench warfare. The stark disconnect between the romanticized propaganda, featuring gallant charges and noble sacrifices, and the mud-soaked, disease-ridden reality of the trenches led many soldiers to question everything they'd been taught about honor and glory. Yet even in these darkest moments, beauty found ways to persist. Soldiers wrote home about spectacular blood-orange sunsets over no man's land, the defiant melody of birdsong piercing dawn's silence, and small wildflowers pushing through shell-cratered earth. The war's brutal crucible transformed how survivors viewed existence itself. Every mundane comfort, a warm bed, a home-cooked meal, a familiar street, took on near-sacred significance. Those who lived through the trenches gained an almost painful awareness of life's brevity and preciousness. Many veterans carried this heightened appreciation alongside their trauma, seeing both the world's beauty and its capacity for horror with new clarity. While some soldiers never made it home, those who did often returned fundamentally altered, bearing physical and psychological scars that their pre-war selves could never have imagined. African American soldiers, having fought for democracy abroad, returned to face crushing discrimination at home. This pattern would tragically repeat itself when their children's generation was called to serve in World War II. Barry's innovative use of divine narrators adds a profound metaphysical dimension to this human suffering. Through their immortal perspective, we see how the gods themselves might envy humanity, not for our achievements or empires, but for our capacity to love with the fierce urgency that comes from knowing we will die. When Aphrodite confesses she would trade her eternal beauty for Hazel's mortal life in less than a heartbeat, it crystallizes the story's central truth, that love's intensity springs from its very impermanence. The interplay between Apollo and Hades further develops this theme, suggesting that true vision transcends mere physical sight. Their observation that whether you see a scarred face or a love for the ages is up to you becomes a meditation on how humanity's greatest strength may be our ability to find beauty and meaning even in our darkest hours.